This is an On the Media podcast extra. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, another battle in the tug of war between justice and reconciliation in the wake of Ireland's time of troubles. That is, the battles between the Irish Republican Army and the Loyalist paramilitaries that raged from the 70s into the 90s.
The bomb blew apart the Horse and Broom pub in Guildford, killing 5 people and injuring 50 more. An hour later, another pub 200 yards up the road was also bombed. Then a month later at Woolwich in South London, another soldier's pub was bombed and 2 people were killed.
This latest chapter involves an ongoing legal battle over the Belfast Project, an archive of taped testimonies from both sides of the conflict in Northern Ireland. The recordings are housed inside Boston College Library, unavailable to the public and law enforcement because the interviewees were promised that their testimonies would not be released until after their deaths. But since 2011, British officials have been trying to get at those tapes, using the US-UK Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty to subpoena Boston College. This week saw the delivery of yet another subpoena, ordering Boston College to provide recordings of Anthony McIntyre, who happens to be the Belfast Project's lead researcher and interviewer, and who also served 18 years in prison for an IRA-related murder. We spoke to McIntyre in 2014 when he was in the middle of the last subpoena battle. That time, the British authorities demanded and ultimately received from the project archived interviews related to the unsolved murder of Jean McConville, dragged from her home in front of her kids in 1972.
Jean McConville's abduction, torture, murder, and secret burial by the IRA nearly 40 years ago leaves many unanswered questions. The mother of Ten's body was dumped on a County Louth beach and, despite extensive searches, was only found in 2003 by a passing walker.
Anthony McIntyre, whose credentials include a PhD in political science, began recording the oral histories in the spring of 2001 for nearly 6 years, collecting 26 interviews with IRA members, people who had every reason to trust him.
I served a life sentence for IRA activity, including the killing of a member of the Ulster Volunteer Force. And I've been involved in the hunger strikes back in 1981 and 1980. And on the blanket protest along with Bobby Sands. And I had first went to prison when I was 16. I was released when I was 18. I returned to prison when I was 18 and was released when I was 35. And I was known to these people to be trustworthy.
What promises did you make to them?
That these interviews would not be released until their death or with their consent prior to that. And that neither the Provisional IRA nor the British state would be allowed to access those interviews.
One of your interviewees, Brendan Hughes, died, and a book came out by your collaborator on the project, journalist Ed Maloney. In the book, Brendan Hughes figured prominently. He told you that Gerry Adams was involved in the murder of Jean McConville, something that Adams has denied. Here's a little bit of Brendan Hughes's tape.
I never carried out a major operation without the OK or the order from Gerry. And for him to sit in his plush office in Westminster Stormont or wherever and deny it, I mean, it's like Hitler denying that there was a rare Holocaust.
Well, during the course of the interview, Brendan revealed a lot of his life in the IRA. Gerry Adams was his operational commander in Belfast, and that Gerry Adams had ordered the killing of Jean McConville, had ordered the London bombings, and had ordered a lot of IRA activity. Brendan Hughes and Gerry Adams were very close comrades in the IRA back in the day.
Boston College, having been confronted with this order to turn over the entire archive, calls it a victory that it doesn't have to turn the whole thing over, only 11 documents.
What Boston College secured was a minimizing of the defeat. That is what we secured. the state seemed to have a view that we were dealing with pushover professors and we will get anything we want out of them. And they weren't far
pushover
wrong.
Pushover professors?
Yes.
And they weren't very far wrong, you were saying?
No, they weren't very far wrong. There should never have been a discussion about whether we do this or we don't. They should have been straight out of the traps and said, we will fight this head on. Mm-hmm. Rather, Boss and Kelly's were transmitting messages to the Justice Department and law enforcement that we are willing to fold if you give us the right opportunity. But unfortunately for Boston College, myself, my wife and Ed Maloney decided to stand and fight. And because we fought, Boston College then were embarrassed.
Okay, let's consider the arguments on both sides of this issue. The British Secretary of State for Northern Ireland said in a special on CNN that no one is above the law.
We've been quite clear as a government that can be no concept of an amnesty. So we have to support the police in bringing those who committed crimes to justice.
That's fine. What he actually means is that nobody outside law enforcement is above the law, because the British authorities have withheld vital information from the relatives of the murdered human rights lawyer, Pat Finucane, murdered by agents of the British state. The British state have withheld vital documents from the victims and families of the people killed in the Dublin Monaghan bombings in May 1974.
I hear what you're saying, that they're having a double standard.
Well, absolutely. But I mean, people in Boston and in America should know British double standards from the War of Independence out there. So I don't think you should be too surprised about British double standards.
Okay, then the argument for the lawyer for the McConville family says that the wounds of the Troubles can never heal. While injustice, like the murder of Mrs. McConville, is allowed to fester.
I have a great deal of sympathy for the lawyer's sentiment, and I have enormous sympathy for the family of Jean McConville and the family for any person killed. But it is not the task of a researcher to become a gatherer of evidence for law enforcement, even for clergymen. Now, one can argue that researchers produce knowledge and clergymen produce nonsense. Yet clergymen are allowed to maintain confidentiality and researchers aren't. It seems to me to be a bizarre situation. There are certain obstacles that have to stand in the way of the state for the betterment of society. And I think that academics and journalists need to be protected from this sort of encroachment and incursion. If the only view of society that we have, the only view of the past, is that of law enforcement, we will learn very little from it.
But how can it really affect policy and improve somebody's life if you don't get to look into it until 30 years hence and the people who committed the wrongdoing on both sides of the struggle are never brought to account?
Well, I mean, we have a situation in the North where the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair, said that the criminal justice system had to be turned on its head in order to bring about the Good Friday Agreement. Basically, politics in the North of Ireland did trump justice, and it's also trumped truth. Truth in the North of Ireland is used for recrimination, not for reconciliation. They want to use it to yesterday's issues to fight the political battles of today. This information wasn't gathered by ourselves as researchers to hand over to relatives, because people are simply going to clam up. All the knowledge that could have been brought to the families at some point under a variety of processes about truth recovery in the past has now been sabotaged by this issue. I mean, it is very sad that the McConvilles cannot get the truth. I think that the McConville family are behaving nobly and honourably. It's just that I represent a different constituency of knowledge, and ne'er the twain shall meet.
Ed Maloney, your colleague in the Belfast Project, has said that the release of the tapes could endanger your life. Do you really think that's a realistic concern?
I am going to see people coming for me, even when they're not coming for me, because I'm in the eye of the storm and I'm sensitive. Former colleagues can be very vitriolic and bitter. Some of them with great audacity and chutzpah, who many of us have for a long time suspected have been informers, and I calling the participants of the Boston College Project informers. It's a load of old hooey, but we must be very cautious. But if you're asking me, do I live under the bed, fearful that I'm going to be attacked imminently? No, I don't.
That was Belfast Project lead researcher Andrew McIntyre in 2014. Jack Dunn is director of news and public affairs at Boston College. In 2014, he took issue with McIntyre's criticism of the college, saying it had done everything in its power to protect the interviews.
We hired the best lawyer available to fight the subpoenas, and we won a significant court case that reduced the number of recorded materials from 85 to 11 interviews that were ultimately required to go over to the police services of Northern Ireland.
McIntyre says that rather than lobbying politicians to protect the manuscripts, the college instead set about undermining him and Maloney. Now, you claim, I think, that the comments by McIntyre and Maloney hurt your efforts to protect the manuscript.
What happened is the first subpoena occurred shortly after Ed Maloney published his book, Voices from the Grave, and after his video of the same name was released in Ireland. There's no doubt in our mind that the children of Jean McConville, who were victims themselves in this, they heard that there was a university that had in its archive recordings of conversations with IRA members that could shed light on their mother's murder. So they apparently sought the help of the police services of Northern Ireland to issue a subpoena to the United States. And then, to our astonishment, Ed Maloney said in interviews in American newspapers that Boston College should burn the tapes. And that sort of rhetoric that we might somehow burn materials, which is something no university would ever consider, no doubt prompted the second subpoena.
McIntyre says that the loss to history of this whole episode is very grave. It irreparably harms the possibility that people will really know what happened during the Troubles. And Boston College should have had the courage to stand up and engage in an act of civil disobedience.
It's just a clash of cultures between American University that's obviously going to be respondent to a U.S. court subpoena, and an individual from Northern Ireland with a long criminal record who just seems to have an utter disregard for the legal process and a suspicion of any authority.
What about the issue of the loss to history?
The shame of it is that Anthony conducted the interviews with the IRA members, and those who've heard the tape said that his work was very weak. Kevin O'Neill from Boston College said that he was stunned by how leading the questions were.
You feel he conducted shoddy interviews?
A lot of critics, such as Danny Morrison, a former IRA member himself, have been critical of Anthony McIntyre, suggesting that he interviewed only people who held the same viewpoint that he did, people who would be critical of Gerry Adams.
McIntyre's pushed back and said that the efforts by the Irish police to get the tape is part of a campaign against Gerry Adams. So everyone is charging this as a campaign against Gerry Adams, but perhaps not admissible as evidence, right?
Probably not. I think Mr. McIntyre and I would agree on that, that the information would probably not have value in a court of law. As we all have pointed out, one of the great ironies is that Boston College, in this very Burns Library, holds the recordings of conversations that led to the various paramilitary groups laying down their arms. And the condition is they will not be available to anyone for 30 years. The police services of Northern Ireland have gone after the tapes of the IRA members, but never requested tapes of the UVF members.
Has Boston College changed its procedures for gathering oral histories?
I think everyone in the world will change the way they undertake oral histories. When this project began in 2000, everyone followed the Columbia University model, which said oral histories really wouldn't be subject to institutional review board. I think that has changed. There would certainly be a heightened scrutiny today. All of the participants entered into this agreement with good intentions. Some good came of it. Clearly mistakes were made on all four of the parties involved. And the reality is the promise of the Belfast Project has been lessened. The political reality clearly got in the way. And now I think we have all learned a need for heightened caution as anyone embarks on such a project.
Jack, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Jack Dunn directs the News and Public Affairs Office at Boston College. This is an On the Media podcast extra. For more OTM, you can find us on Twitter at On the Media and sign up for our newsletter on our website at onthemedia.org. Thanks for listening.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.